The Fern Line is supported by the Alaska Rock Gym, providing quality indoor climbing to the Anchorage community since 1995. Alaska Rock Gym sports 20,000 square feet of climbing, an entire floor of boulder terrain, beautiful locker rooms, plus expanded cardio fitness and yoga rooms. Stop by anytime to take a tour of the facility or check out the Alaska Rock Gym online at alaskarockgym.com.
Hey, Evan, did you hear that?
Dude, it's a hoarding marmot. Looking for that last-minute piece of kit before heading into the hills? Make sure and stop by the Hoarding Marmot, Anchorage's finest outdoor consignment shop located in the heart of Spinard. The Hoarding Marmot has everything you need from high-end mountaineering gear, cross-country and downhill ski equipment, as well as a fine selection of local guidebooks, maps, and yummy trail snacks. Stop by the Hoarding Marmot next time you roll through town or check them out online at hoardingmarmot.com. All right, let's get to the show. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On Season 3, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of creativity in the mountains and in their daily lives. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with extraordinary people, the folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in some of the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. All right, well, it's great to be back with you for another episode of The Fern Line. I hope you're all having a great summer. It's been a hot one here in Alaska, and man, I'm still crossing my fingers here for some more rain. Hey, before we dive into the episode today, I just want to share with all of you that I've got t-shirts for sale. I'm doing a limited edition run through Bonfire, and basically the way it works is you set a goal. I've set a goal to sell 50 of these shirts. The shirts are available to order until July 27th, and they will ship out around August 5th. So if you want to check out these t-shirt designs, just head on over to thefernline.com, click on the Support the Fern Line tab, and then you can click on t-shirts. So a few other ways you can help support The Fern Line: you can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can tell someone directly. You know, word of mouth is the best way to get information out there. That's kind of how our community rolls. So make sure you tell your friends, tell your climbing partners, people you think might dig The Fern Line. Let them know it's out there. And finally, if you want to support this show from the ground up, you can become a monthly subscriber over at Patreon. Just head on over to patreon.com/thefernline and you can sign up there. All right, well, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch, camp chair, or in your woodworking shop, and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line.
I found by taking the path of a creative, it's really easy for people to sort of assume there's going to be hardship as well as passion. And I've sort of decided that, you know, well, if there is some of that hardship, I always feel like those rough times in life are sort of like that time you end up in the middle of the alder field, and maybe there's alders and muskeg at the same time, who knows? Those moments that sort of suck are just part of the game, and right. You know, it's part of life too.
On today's episode of The Fern Line, we'll get to know Alaskan-based wilderness adventurer, woodworker, potter, and teacher, Tony Pirelli. Tony grew up in the farm country of Wisconsin, playing sports as a kid, but also developing a passion for the outdoors, fishing and canoeing with his family and grandparents. After college, Tony found himself in Alaska, working as a teacher for the Anchorage School District, and also meeting a group of friends that would introduce him to mountaineering and pack rafting. These formative experiences would shape his life and instill a deeper sense of love and respect for the wilderness. Since that time, Tony has continued refining his life, stripping away the excesses, and focusing instead on living simply, working with his hands, and sharing unique life experiences and connections with others. Last winter, I got to sit down with Tony to talk about his life in the mountains and the wilderness, as well as the creative endeavors he chooses to pursue and share with others. Like many conversations on the Fernline, we started by talking about Tony's inspirations as a kid, and later, how a random encounter would lead him to Alaska.
Yes, I grew up in Wisconsin, in what I always thought was like this little woodsy town with farms nearby. And after living in Alaska for 15 years, I go back and it's a little farming town with woods nearby. And flying over it, you see it's mostly farm, a little bit of woods. But I spent a lot of time, you know, in those days it was hunting, walking, playing out in the woods generally as a kid with a family that was involved in, you know, hunting and fishing. I found out at some point that I didn't really care if I carried a gun anymore and I just wanted to be outside. Right. And my grandparents had a little cabin in the woods in northern Wisconsin. I'd be there for, 2 to 5 weeks every summer with just Granny and Grandpa John and me. Fishing a little bit, but mostly rowing the boat around, hiking in the woods. We had 7 acres and I was sort of a free bird there.
Like in junior high and like your high school kind of times, like what were some things that you were doing that inspired you during that time of your life?
In the time and place where I grew up, it felt mandatory as a boy to be involved in sports. You know what I mean? And I liked it. I was really involved in football, track and field. I wrestled a little bit. I got really excited and inspired about fitness stuff. So I'd spend a lot of time in the weight room, which, you know, just seems a little bit like a far leap from the way, you know, our community lives now. But, you know, it was about setting goals. It was about working hard. It was about sort of understanding that there's good pain and not good pain. And to be honest, when you're doing that kind of work, there is a lot of sort of, I don't know if it's endorphins or serotonin. There's a lot of good things you gain from spending that time. Yeah, so I was pretty dedicated to sports and sort of that fitness aspect.
Right.
Yeah.
Kind of in that same time period, were you engaging in any creative pursuits at that time in your life other than sports? Cause I mean, sports can be creative in its own way.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. In a sense that when I go back to my mom's house in this little corner where my stuff is, I would take I sort of forgot about this. I would take old appliances and gut out the copper wires and form them into trees. And I have this massive collection of these little copper wire trees and these little leather cutouts, which I'm not sure what I did with those, but I did a lot of that. And then my notebooks, which for whatever reason, some of those things are still around. My notebooks, every free space was covered in some sort of doodle. Whether that doodle represented, you know, sometimes it'd represent, you know, a game or a person. And sometimes it'd just be a shape that I felt like if I make this shape over and over again, it got a little cooler every time, and right. So there'd just be, you know, dozens of these random little circles with spiky things or whatever.
You know, after high school, so you're in Wisconsin, doing sports and making doodles and doing things with your family and, you know, outdoorsy things. You ended up going to college, right?
Yeah.
Can you talk about where you went to college and maybe just talk about that part of your life?
So I went to the University of Wisconsin, Whitewater. You know, the first part of that, I felt still pretty engaged in sports. And creative-wise, it didn't maybe evolve all that much yet. There was a part of my college life that I was more interested in fun than deeper meaning, maybe. You know, like some college people are.
Right.
And I would still get outside a lot, but fun was more a social thing. And as far as making, you know, I wrote a lot in college. I wrote a lot of poems. And I would think about life the way college kids do, maybe, and sort of project to the future. And so more writing then, which is interesting. I still do some writing, but it's not something I tend to put out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I studied, classically, I was undecided for a bunch of years, and I had this idea, like, I will look at the course catalog and just take the courses that were really interesting to me.
Right.
Which I don't think is a bad way to go about it.
No.
It doesn't get you out of there quickly, but I don't do many things quickly. So I was studying mostly fitness things and got interested in education a little bit. And so I was taking some education classes and I had to sit down with my advisor. And without intending to, I had most of a physical education degree sort of wrapped up. And so I went forward with that. The education part was really inspiring and showing students that moving your body and being active is fun is inspiring to me. And that led to studies of special needs as well. So I did, you know, a lot of special education courses.
So like what degrees do you hold in school?
So I've got a bachelor's degree in physical education, okay, health education, and adaptive physical education.
So what happened in your life after college?
So after college, I had enough student loans, et cetera, that I knew I wanted to get a job. And I was really passionate about learning about teaching. So I wanted to find a teaching gig. And I'd been doing, at that point, quite a few backcountry trips in the Midwest. So a lot of backpacking, a lot of canoeing, and reading Backpacker magazine.
Right.
So I was sort of applying for teaching gigs in Washington and Oregon, in Colorado, thinking I got to get to Washington, Oregon, or Colorado. And I joined a friend to a job fair that was all Alaska school districts with no intention of taking a job, but practicing the interviewing skills. And so, Right. Yeah, I was sort of in that moment where you're primed for some change, you're primed for some growth, excited about working and excited about seeing new places. And, you know, the Midwest is really beautiful and the trips we did there were great, but I'd never seen a mountain. I'd never been in a river more than like a mellow canoeing situation, which all, you know, is quite wonderful, but I was excited for something else.
Right. So how did you end up coming up to Alaska? What time period was that? And what specifically brought you up here?
So it was about a year or less than a year after graduating. I was working as a sub a little bit, getting outside a little bit, teaching a little bit of outdoor education stuff. And I'm taking out the trash one day and my neighbor says, "Hey, Tony, we're going to this job fair. You should come with. It's a good chance to practice your interviewing skills." And so a couple of days later, we go to a place it's all Alaskan school districts. And with the idea of it's a good time to maybe put on a clean shirt and try to have that conversation. And you get to do it over and over in the same,
okay,
same place.
Interesting.
Yeah. And the Anchorage school district will sort of, or Alaska school districts will pick parts of the country and they'll go do that, this big recruiting campaign. So I go there with a girlfriend of mine and this couple who lives next door, and we all walk away with jobs. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty weird. And the district did a nice thing. Like, they give you a contract, you know, if you are offered a job. And the idea is you cannot sign this contract today. We intend to hire you if you sign this and return it in 10 days, give or take. So they want you to go home and chew on it.
Yeah.
And a few days into that, I remember the four of us got together to sort of talk about it. And I said, regardless of what we talk about tonight, I've signed my papers and we're going, or I'm going. You know, I'm not making that decision for anybody else. And yeah, so we got some momentum and drove up here.
Wow.
Yeah.
Although Tony came to Alaska to be a teacher, it was a newfound group of friends that would expand his horizons from the classroom and into the mountains. I asked Tony to talk about this formative time in his life and to share some of the most meaningful adventures that he's experienced over the years.
It was a teaching job at Anchorage School District. I was hired to teach PE at Service High School. which was awesome. I met a lot of the people I'm still friends with now. It wasn't a great fit teaching-wise. I have a really sport-based, or at the time, we're talking 2003, a really sport-based PE program, and I was a little bit more fitness-based, enjoyment of just learning to move your body in ways that help you. And I was really growing interested in the special needs aspect of PE. But at that time, you're moving to a new place and you need a job. And it was a great job to have. And Anchorage School District's cool in that you can transfer pretty easily. And so you get in and you find the job that might be a better fit and you make that move. So the next year, while I was here, while I was teaching at Service, I looked into the adaptive PE world. It's where there's, at that time, there are 10 adaptive PE teachers and they travel around the district and do physical education for students with special needs. And that's all they teach. Mm-hmm. And that was perfect for me. And so, I got to know those people, made some connections, and it worked out well that I was able to get hired to do that the next year.
I know you a little bit personally, and so I know that after you came to Alaska, you got into the outdoors more. Mm-hmm. And so can you just talk a little bit about what you discovered when you came to Alaska as far as the mountains around you and how did you get into that? And what were some experiences that were meaningful to you when you look back on it, maybe in the mountains?
I think I already said I moved to Alaska before I'd really seen, mountains for the most part. Certainly never climbed one. And I remember the second day in town, you drive to a spot, you're in town and you're a little disheveled. Anchorage isn't always what you think it's going to be when you're driving up and you're thinking about Alaska. And I drove into REI because I recognized REI. And I was walking around the book section and I looked probably really confused. And someone came over and asked if they could help me. And I remember just not knowing what to say other than I'm like, so I'm in town. I see those mountains and I don't know what to do. I don't know how to get there. I'm comfortable and independent enough that if you can tell me how to get there, I'll go do something and be excited about that. And so they gave me a book, they gave me a map, the most classic books and maps that anyone who lives in the state has, and told me I need to go out to the parking lot, get in my car, and drive down the Seward Highway. I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that one of these days. He's like, no, you don't understand. You need to leave the store after you buy these things and drive down the Seward Highway, which we did. So that was just the first time Anchorage in the mountains maybe, and I made a little bit of an introduction. And we're talking about like Beluga Point. We're not talking about the top of Mount Eucla or something.
Right.
But it was still pretty cool. And like a lot of the stories in this world of outdoor mountains and rivers and stuff, they do revolve around the people.
Right.
And so I'm working at Service High School and I get to know a couple individuals. First, Scott Hauser, and he introduced me to JT Lindholm. And I had a philosophy or a little personal rule, and it was sort of a two-part rule that if I'm invited on an adventure, I'd say yes. And I'd follow that up with letting them know I don't know how to do anything. And so I don't know how to do any of these things. I want to go, and I was fortunate enough at the time to have a strength base that I could hang,
right.
And as soon as it got technical, I was the number two. I was just smart enough to know I have to follow up the yes with something else, which turned into just a bunch of years of just lots of moments in the mountains and rivers with, in those years with JT, and then like a lot of things that spreads, and I sort of think about this idea of, there's a swarm of really amazing adventurers and I somehow ended up in this circle with this swarm of really amazing people always saying yes and always reminding them like I'm pretty new and they just took me under their wing. The first time getting into the High Chugach on our way to climb Mount Soggy. Old Soggy was probably the first time that I felt like I'm a mountain guy. I'm a mountain person. Who knew?
Right?
And so, in those days, it could have been a single night trip. It could have been a really fast paced single night trip. And we would go up there and we would camp in this high valley that we later on, I like to call the Valley of Life. I've seen a really rich amount of wildlife there. We had a close encounter with a wolverine, black bear, sheep, goats, I've never seen a moose up in there. So we go and we climb Old Soggy. And that was one of those moments where you realize this is more than just fun. Like, I care about this. This is meaningful. Right. And, you know, I ask that question a lot in life now. Like, is this meaningful? Do I care about it? Or is this just fun?
Right.
And it's fine to do things that are just fun. I don't want to live my whole life doing things that are just fun and not meaningful. But that was a big one. And then, you know, later on with the same crew of people, you know, it turned into climbing stuff and also pack rafting. And that led to some trips in the Arctic. And I'll always sort of lean on the Arctic if someone wants to hear about a meaningful place that you were able to travel in and either saw, or felt, or experienced something special.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely some Arctic refuge trips that were turning points for me. So it was a trip, several days, weekend, where we were crossing. We're in the Marsh Fork of the Canning area. We cross over to a place called Carnivore Creek, spend another day to get over to a river called the Hulahula.
Right.
About halfway down the Hulahula, and I'm abbreviating everything here.
Sure.
Have it down the Hulahula, a windstorm picks up. And it gets windy enough where early afternoon, a time that feels too early to stop and camp, we need to get off the river because our boats are actually, you know, we're in our alpaca rafts, fully loaded, and the wind is so strong, we feel like my boat might tip over. And that person next to me is about 100 pounds. Her boat's definitely going to tip, but like, we need to get off the river.
Right.
So we pull over, the sun's blazing, the wind's blazing, you can't set up a tent, you can't sleep, and we just kind of hang out for, oh, I don't know how many hours, a lot of hours. Midnight rolls around, and the wind totally dies. And so, okay, nobody slept, it's a foolish time to start up again, but the sun's not gonna go down, and the wind might pick up again. If this is the time that we can travel again, which on this particular trip we needed to keep going and catch our flight home. And so I guess I'm trying to paint a picture a little bit of a 1 a.m. float on zero sleep on the Hulahula on the plains of the Arctic Refuge. Everybody's sort of dozing off, which is actually quite dangerous. There's off ice all over.
Yeah.
But so you're fighting to stay awake. You're helping your friends stay awake. And we'd stop a lot and scout. I had a pair of binoculars, and we'd scout the river for off ice and see how much ice is in the river to make absolutely sure we feel like we can keep going. So we're stopping, we're scoping, we're stopping, we're scoping, and I'm standing on this little bump, this little rise in the plain, and the landscape's moving, and I haven't slept in a really long time, and I can get a little bit weird without sleep. And I don't say anything to anybody, I just keep staring, and the landscape continues just like it's fuzzy, and it's just moving a little bit. And I realize that it's full of life. Not the tundra life, but it's full of caribou.
Wow.
But there's enough caribou where I can't discern where the caribou end and the tundra begins.
Wow.
And they're just kind of moving. I'm getting goosebumps now. And so we're like, whoa. And we pass around the binoculars and we determine like, yep, it's definitely caribou. How many? Some number that I can't count.
Wow.
Right? And they're a ways off. You know, they're far enough away that the binoculars they're still kind of hard to see. And so we get back in the water and we're pretty giddy and nobody's sleepy anymore. Like, you're stoked. You're like, we're gonna see the porcupine caribou herd. And we're getting closer. And it's almost like you start seeing a few animals and then all of a sudden, boom, there's just a wall of caribou. And so we pull over in this eddy, you know, where the water stops and has a little break and nobody's talking. Like, there's times, you know, at a ceremony where you just know that we don't talk here. And when you're face to face with this wall of caribou,
right.
Like, we just knew, like, we don't talk here. We experience this without messing it up with words. And somebody looks around, we're all looking around at each other, and Sarah Heck's in this group, and she looks around, and she gets this little smirk on her face and just pulls out of the eddy. And I remember thinking, like, I totally just want to float into this wall of caribou. And she did that, right? As I was thinking, I think I'm going to do that. And then everybody just followed. And as we're floating down, you know, this wall of caribou parts. And the caribou on the right kind of want to be on the left. And so they bolt to the left. And the caribou on the left want to be on the right. And they're crisscrossing. And the calves are getting kind of over here. And they're making their little, you know, caribou calf sounds. And getting back united with their mom. And that went on for about 3 or 4 hours.
Damn.
Like, an amount of caribou that you can't count for 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah.
And somewhere in there, we take a break, you know, we took a lot of breaks and just tried to take it in. And I watched a grizzly bear chase caribou around. And he knew, like, he would watch a group of caribou, and a caribou would go up on a high point and look down on the bear, and then go back to the bigger group of caribou and be like, yeah, bear's there. He's just chilling. And then the caribou would get active, and another caribou, or excuse me, the grizzly bear would get active again, and the caribou would send a scout. It was pretty cool to see this interaction between this grizzly bear and the caribou, and they were very wary of each other. The bear didn't seem to have a chance at that moment because the caribou were so on to him. But we got to witness that.
Right.
Yeah.
I've actually known Tony for a long time, and although we don't see each other that much, I've watched and admired his life's journey over the years, in particular, his ongoing search for a simpler way of living. So I asked Tony to talk about some of the people and experiences that have influenced this path and how this relates to his mountain and creative pursuits today.
Really got interested in sort of the idea of simple living and the homestead lifestyle. And that keyed me into reading about, the Nearings, which are an old homesteading couple on the East Coast, the Hubbards, you know, there's all these different, these sort of iconic.
The Watermans,
totally, which were connected to the Nearings. And then in that line of people, there's a guy named Bill Copperthwaite, and I got a hold of one of his books, and he was still alive. You know, some of those other people that we mentioned, some are, some aren't. And so this guy lives in this wonderful little round cabin on the coast of Maine, off-grid. I write him a letter. He writes back. We have some dialogue. And at the same time, I got really involved in learning about the Dick Pernicke story on a pretty long traverse of that part of Alaska, hiking, pack rafting, climbing stuff. We passed through there. And so maybe I'm telling two stories at once. Maybe I'll focus on Bill Copperthwaite a little bit first, just because I said his name first. So Bill Copperthwaite, we start some dialogue, and he says, you should come visit me. And I said, yes, I should come visit you. And so Becky and I flew to the East Coast, and to get to Bill's homestead, we drive to the small town called Machias. Maybe it's called Machiasport. And it's a mile and a half walk into his house. And at the time we meet him, he's 82 years old. So we walk in, and he's eagerly waiting, like he knew the day we were going to arrive. We were probably a little bit late. We're coming from Alaska to Maine. Of course, we're going to be a little bit late.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And we developed a relationship with him where we stayed there for about a week and just offered ourselves openly. If you have work that you have a hand with, that you need a hand with, we'll offer work. If you have adventures you want to do, we'll offer ourselves to be adventure buddies. And so he was really excited about that. And so we did work, mostly work, some adventure. He had 300 acres on the coast. So we were in canoes, we were in the woods, we were doing stuff.
Wow.
In fact, he was known for the things he built. And we helped build the foundation to his last building, which was, I mean, in that kind of life, your foundation is a big hole in the ground with a cedar stump. And at 82, he was the toughest 82-year-old I've ever met. But I think he was also glad to have a 35-year-old dude and a 35-year-old girl strutting around.
Right.
Yeah. And so we did that. And this is another story where I could talk too much about. But so Bill Copperthwaite's a very important person in my life. And I noticed at Bill's place, this is before I was really interested in carving at all. I was really interested in pottery. I'd done a lot of pottery. But at Bill's place, there's wooden bowls everywhere, and there's wooden spoons everywhere, and there's wooden chairs everywhere. Everything in Bill's house was either beautiful or had a really important function. Usually it was a little bit of both. And so maybe I'll pause that story there for a minute. And within the same time frame of my life, on this other adventure, we hike and climb and pack raft and spend a day at Dick Pernicke's place. And this was a few years after he had passed away. And there's a couple there named Kay and Monroe. And Kay and Monroe were taking care of Dick's place on behalf of the Park Service as volunteers. And they knew Dick, and they had kept up his cabin, and I credit them with the reason that cabin is still there. And that's also a place that's really easy to have a lot of reverence for. Yeah. And you look around Dick's place, and there's a wooden bowl here and a wooden spoon here and this wooden bench that he built. And I started to sort of notice that as I pursue all these people that I think are living really intentionally, these are full value lifestyles where they see a way that they can focus on what's important and let the rest fall away. And that comes with costs. And I've gotten to know these people and their stories well enough that I know there's costs with that. But very intentional, full value lifestyles. And these wooden objects keep showing up. And then the more I learn about it, you know, that's not uncommon. And I began to see carving and that kind of craft, you know, where you're using oftentimes traditional, but it doesn't need to be, but these traditional skills and tools with materials that are in the backyard. Mm-hmm. They're not, I mean, there's some really beautiful exotic woods, but if you live in a spruce forest or a birch forest or a boreal state, there's really beautiful wood there too. And so I really grew to see those objects as maybe an open door, a symbol. You know, they offer a connection to a way of life. They offer a connection to a person, and they offer, I really think they offer a connection to wilderness and nature. Mm-hmm. So the object's not important. The story and the symbol is really important. And so I grabbed onto that idea really strong. So let's take us back to Maine. Becky and I are working at Bill Copperthwaite's, living and working, doing a variety of projects. And once we had this foundation pretty well fixed, he thought, you know, we're at a really good spot. He asked us, well, what can I do for you? You're here and you're working, and I enjoy your company. What can I do for you? And so Becky and I decided we would love to learn how you make some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. He's like, I would love to show you how to make some of this stuff. And so he's like, I know where there's a birch tree. And now think about this statement and his connection to his home. Right. Not everybody could say this, but I know where there's a birch tree about a quarter mile away that in the last windstorm we had, I'm sure fell down. Like, that's an intimate connection with, you know, his footprint, his place of living. And he's like, you know where the saws are, you know where the axes are. If you go there, I bet we can find a good piece of wood for a bowl and some spoons. And he showed us about what size. And so Becky and I went and did that. And the next day we spent carving. He's got some really awesome ancient tools. And he's got these tools he invented that have different levers. So it's a hand tool, but he'll put a fulcrum on it so that you all of a sudden have all this leverage. And just a really creative individual. And we carved bowls with him and we carved spoons with him. You know, you take that interest, that sort of fire that's building in you, and you're like, wow, this is so much more interesting than I thought it was. And now this iconic human is showing me how to do it. It was just a really nice moment for us. And I'd like to maybe follow that up with, after that time carving with Bill on his land, as well as some other adventures, you know, about a year later, he got in a car accident. And so although he lived off grid, he did have a car on the end of this mile and a half trail. And so he was in a car accident and died like the year after we saw him and got to know him. And we traveled back for his celebration of life. And I've held on to that as, you know, so we're all gonna die someday. And this moment that we return to see this place and this person and his story, I've never seen so many people gather and express love and gratitude in a way as at this place. And so as unique as I think that story is of what Becky and I did, we come to learn that like that wasn't all that original in his life. Right. You know, that was meaningful in our life. And I'm sure it was meaningful for him, but there were, you know, a lot of other people who knew his story, wrote a letter, and went out and did projects with Bill Copperthwaite. We did have the honor. We were invited to, in his will, he wanted something edible planted on his grave, so a fruit tree or berry bush. And so Becky and I had the honor of planting the blueberries that still live on his grave. Wow. Which, I mean, again, for an individual to decide I want something edible to grow amongst my grave, like that's sort of this idea of, you know, gratitude to the world and generosity that he wants to continue after he's gone. Yeah. Holy cow. Yeah. That's cool.
I really enjoy getting to talk with artists, partly because I love to hear their stories, but also because I can relate to them. It's a never-ending learning experience for me to hear other people's stories about what inspires them and how that manifests into a creative experience. So I decided to close out my conversation with Tony, talking about his art, his creative process, and also what it's like to try and make a living as an artist.
I am making a living as someone new to being an artist. And I still, you know, with the education background mm-hmm. and the wilderness background, I do some teaching as an adjunct professor at APU. So Becky and I co-teach the wilderness travel and pack rafting course.
Radical.
Yeah. Yeah. We were honored to have that handed down to us.
Right.
I do a little bit of work. I help do some killer whale research on a vessel out in Prince William Sound. And I teach occasional pack raft and wilderness weekend workshops. So we're adding up a whole bunch of careers, none of which are all that lucrative.
Right.
But each is fulfilling.
Right.
Yeah.
You're describing basically what myself and what a lot of artistic people do to make a living is you piece a bunch of things together to be able to live a certain lifestyle or to pursue something that is really important to you.
Maybe part of it, as well as piecing together a variety of jobs that are interesting or important to you, is living a little bit more simply. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly, you know, in the longer story I just told, that's certainly a big part of it.
Right.
You know, a little bit simpler life allows you maybe to pursue things out of passion versus what's lucrative.
Like, what are some of the things that you've had to give up to live the lifestyle that you're pursuing right now? And on the flip side, what are some things that you get that maybe you wouldn't get if you were living in the middle of a city and maybe working like a steady, like a 9-to-5 job or something?
One of the things one gains, or one of the things that I've gained, and this is maybe a gain and a non-gain, is the freedom. And so I really like the idea of not having to... Or maybe I'll put it in a different way. I really like the idea of being able to build my own schedule. And that means that, you know, I can use the weather to help me determine it. I can use that, you know, my motivation to help me choose that. On the flip side, what I've found is that although I love each of those sort of lines of work very passionately, it in some ways, it's hard to buckle down when there's nobody reminding you that today's the day that we need to get this or this done. And so maybe that speaks to my lack of organization. The passion's there, but yeah. You know, when you're not clocking in, sometimes
right.
It's easy to not get started when you thought you were going to get started or that sort of thing.
Right.
And you know, we live out of town in a small little place that, I mean, at night, every night we hear the owls hooting. You know, there's a lot of nights that a little flying squirrel lands on the windowsill. There's lynx tracks going on the same trail I walk every morning. And that doesn't speak to the profession, but that maybe speaks to the choice of maybe living a little bit on the edge.
Mm-hmm.
And that for me is related because I walk this little trail to my workshop every morning,
right.
You know? So I definitely feel a little bit more settled into my place that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like that. I know those other people we talked about before, you know, those folks are living way out there. And
mm-hmm.
I think they sacrifice a level of social life that I know is a detriment to, you know, at least Bill Copperthwaite's life. I don't know if Dick Pernicke felt that or not.
Right.
So what are some goals that you have with your artistic pursuits moving forward?
In the woodwork in particular, you know, I sort of split my time making pottery and doing the woodwork and the carving, I feel a little bit more capable of passing on some of the carving skills, and particularly that sort of that mindset of a way of looking at things with that little bit different intention, and how objects can be more than just objects. They can symbolize something maybe a little bit more important. And so one of my goals for that maybe is to be a bit of a resource. And maybe I should first tell you like business goals, but those don't come to me first. That's not how I operate, but right. I do a lot of workshops carving, and we use a spoon as the object we carve. I consider a carving workshop before I consider a spoon workshop.
Right.
But it turns into a really cool community setting where we talk about what's important. Mm-hmm. We talk about adventures. We talk about wood. We talk about nature. And I feel like that's maybe based on some of the inputs I've had is maybe something I now have to offer. So maybe we're talking a little bit about having gained so much from interesting people, maybe right. trying to be able to give some of that back.
Right. In talking to you, it sounds like a big component for you in your artistic pursuits is about sharing with other people.
Yeah, it feels like that a lot. And having a chance to talk to you helps me sort of organize those
right.
feelings, those thoughts.
Right.
And then the irony is, you know, my wife Becky and I talk a lot about living someplace a little bit more wild and remote, and those two things don't necessarily go together. So it's, you know, life is sort of funny with that paradox,
right.
living further out in the woods, but also wanting to be more of a social giver. So it's,
right.
yeah, we're navigating that.
I wanted to ask you, beyond like the artistic pursuits and you know, you've shared like some of your maybe potential life goals of refining that simple lifestyle or exploring different parts of the simple lifestyle. What are some things in nature and like the outdoors that you would like to do for, you know, those special experiences and for fun?
Well put. Longer traverses are sort of the most meaningful trips to me. The longer traverses where there's a lot of hiking involved and a fair bit of boating involved. I find myself pursuing a lot of whitewater trips. But I think maybe to get to the question a little bit would be some traverse trips. You know, I spent a lot of time climbing peaks, and I do remember having this tipping point where thinking standing on the peak was awesome. These high fives on the peak are so sweet. But the trip was like all that other part getting to it. And so those walking and floating through the valleys and over the mountain passes, I think. So that might be in the Arctic. That will be in the Arctic, but, you know, who knows where else, you know. But more of those, and that idea of sharing, you know, this next fall we'll teach another pack rafting course, and the idea of getting to show other people how that works will be really cool for us.
Cool.
Yeah.
I guess just before we wrap up, I mean, is there anything else that you would just like to share or say while we're talking here?
A minute ago you talked about, so you used the term path, you know, describe sort of one's life. And it's interesting. I think a lot about life as a path. And, you know, think about a long trip or some of the long climbs I know you've done. And, you know, you choose to go on that trip and there might be some bushwhacking and that's part of the trip. And you can decide if you want to suffer in the bushwhacking or not. Same with going through a field of muskeg. But you're always glad you went. And I found by taking the path of a creative, it's really easy for people to sort of assume there's going to be hardship as well as passion.
Right.
And I've sort of decided that, you know, well, if there is some of that hardship, and so far there hasn't been, but, you know, I always feel like those rough times in life are sort of like that time you end up in the middle of the alder field, and maybe there's alders and muskeg at the same time. Who knows? Like, those moments that sort of suck are just part of the game, and
right.
yeah, it's part of life too.
All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of Tony's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his creativity, his life experience and wisdom, and his outdoor stories that he shared to your next trip in the mountains. If you want to learn more about Tony, if you want to see some of the work that he does, you can check out his website at tonyparelli.org. Hey, don't forget to leave a review for The Fernline over at Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to podcasts. And just another reminder, if you want to pick up one of these limited edition shirts, they are available until July 27th, and you can get those over at thefernline.com. And finally, if you enjoy the tunes you hear on this show, you can check out more of my music on iTunes, Spotify, Bandcamp, and evanphillips.net. All right, friends, until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line. Showing me the way to a place in the country, a home where I could stay. That's one for the child living inside of me. That's two for the old man waiting to be free. I know it's hard when you're laughing at a spark. You gotta keep it together. So close to me. For a while I was looking, stumbling in the dark, till I saw you were out there waiting for my call. There was a time I was fearful, there was a time I was settled down. Now it's off to the races, I got my 2 feet on the ground. That's one for the child living inside of me. That's two for the old man waiting to be free. I know it's hard.